As a science writer and an ecologist, Cornelia Mutel has written about and studied climate change for many years. But in her latest book, she brings the science home to the acreage she lives on in eastern Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A Sugar Creek Chronicle, observing climate change from a Midwestern woodland, weaves an education in climate science into a book that's part environmental observation, part memoir. This hour, I'll talk with Mutel about her life and what we can learn from closely observing the world around us. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with David Huckfeldt and Benson Ramsey of the Pines and photographer Danny Wilcox-Frazier about a unique collaboration. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with David Huckfeldt and Benson Ramsey of the Pines and photographer Danny Wilcox-Frazier about a unique collaboration they're working on. But first, Cornelia Mutel is senior science writer at Hydro Science and Engineering at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. She is an ecologist, and she's written about climate change in the big picture for many years. In her latest work, she goes smaller picture, focusing on her life and the land she lives on. It's called A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. And she'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow night at 7 p.m. She is here in the studio with me now. Connie, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Charity. A pleasure.
Now, I want to ask you, because you have written a lot about climate change over the years, what made you want to focus so closely on the land that you live on?
Well, most of my writing has been about human interactions with the natural world, climate change being one of many. When I realized, not that many years ago, that climate change really is the elephant in the bathtub. If we don't get ahead of climate change, then everything else is lost. I thought, well, what I wanted to write was not a book, not a scientific book about climate change, but rather something that would appeal to the lay reader, appeal to those who maybe are denying climate change, fearful of climate change, not knowing what they can do about it, and just kind of in a conundrum about the whole process. And so I thought about putting together something that would grab them, not just in the head, but also in the belly, something that would work on them, bounce around in their mind, but also work on them and hopefully take them to a point where they were acting as well as thinking about climate change. And the way that I thought I should do that is by telling stories. And so, of course, what I do is I tell stories about nature and I tell stories about my own life and my own struggles with life, including my struggles with health problems, my struggles with my kids, but also the struggles that I saw outside my kitchen window in the natural woodland where my husband and I live, just trying to make those stories appealing so that people would be drawn into reading also the science, which is in the book.
In the introduction of the book, you write about how the spark for this idea, maybe it wasn't born that moment, but it was certainly fanned by your learning that you had another grandchild on the way. What was it about the impending birth of your granddaughter that made you think, I need to write this book now?
Right. Well, the truth of climate change is that it's operating in our world now. It's changing our world. But the worst ramifications are going to be felt by our grandchildren and their grandchildren in the future, not now. And now we're kind of in a warm-up period, as I think of it, for climate change. We're in a period where we still have options. If we don't change our behavior, then those grandchildren will be in a world where they don't have options. All they can do is adapt to a very changed world, a world that I don't think we really want to go to. So I think about my grandchildren. I think about talking to them as a grandmother in 10 or 20 years, if I live that long, and them confronting me and saying, why didn't you do something about this? Why didn't you work to change the world? And I think that my book is an answer to that question, a kind of proactive answer to that question.
To say, I did do something?
I did what I could do. I took my skills and applied them to the problem, which is what we should all do.
Does the way you phrase that makes me feel like maybe not that you've given up hope, but that you're fighting a darkness there to say, I did what I could do. I used my skills in the only way that I knew how to fight climate change in sending this message to your grandchildren. That you have a message of hope in this book, but does part of you feel like this is inevitable?
Well, it's inevitable in that it's already happening, but it's not inevitable that we face the worst ramifications of climate change. And the truth is that the sooner we deal with the problem, the easier it's going to be, the cheaper it's going to be, and the better the results are going to be. And I keep thinking that over and over. So in a way, it's spurring people to try to act earlier rather than later. And no, I'm not hopeless at all. I do think that we still have a lot of options. It's a matter of applying those options, not ignoring them.
Now, take us to the land you live on. You live outside of Iowa City on a wooded acreage. Tell me about your property.
Okay, well, we moved, my husband and I moved there before we had any children. We raised our sons on that land. It's a mature oak hickory forest, which we're now working to restore to its pre-settlement condition, including the native biodiversity, fostering those plants. And it's really my passion in life. It's the thing that, when I think about my life, it's the thing that I would like to leave behind, a healthy, functioning ecosystem. And so I just absolutely love it. I love walking on the land. I love being on the land. I think our sons were shaped by that land. We open it to many friends now, and I think they're reshaped by the land. The book is actually a year-long nature journal, and then I insert into that journal the science of climate change.
The forest that you live in is connected, of course, as all of our land is connected. So in your wanderings, I get the impression that you wander beyond the borders of your property.
Mm-hmm.
And just for people who haven't been in this, you know, a forested area of Iowa is a fairly rare landscape here. And a mature oak hickory forest is even more rare in Iowa today. So for people who haven't spent much time in an area like this, can you give us a kind of a description of what it's like?
Sure. Well, here in Iowa City, people in Iowa City are really, really lucky to have some extensive mature woodlands north of the Iowa City area. And that's what this is typical of. It's got mature oaks, which is the way the land was dominated over 200 years ago. These beautiful big oaks with spreading branches, massive trunks, trees that'll live, if they're given the chance, as many as 300 or 400 years. And so it's really a savanna area. A healthy oak ecosystem is a savanna area that's tended by fire, opened up by fire, with a diversity of understory plants as well. Very, very beautiful in the summer.
And you and your husband have been doing some managed burning.
We have.
Now.
Yeah, we try to do it every year. I'm hoping to get a burn in yet this spring.
And the window is very brief.
Well, yeah, we'd better do it pretty soon. Yep.
You started your observations in January or February, I'm trying to remember the date of the first entry, of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of us, if we pay attention to the weather and the climate and our surroundings, remember 2012 as a very significant weather year. That was the year of the major drought. So that winter was so odd. It was, you quoted people as saying it was the winter that wasn't. That's what people were starting to say about it, because there was unusual warmth even in January and February of that year. There were some ups and downs, but there were a lot of warm days. Had you already noticed that things were strange before you started your observations, or is that something that just kind of happened?
It's one of those serendipities that are totally, totally amaze me, and I'm still dumbstruck by it. When I think about it, 2012, I believe, was the year that probably most Iowans, if they're observant, would say climate change is happening. And it came on us, in my mind, like a flood, like a an earthquake. It was just there. And I actually started on January 1st of that year before we were sensing that things were going to be so askew. And then I just rolled through the year with one, you know, going from our heat wave in March to this large wind that roared across the country. Never had it before. It's called a derecho, and it reached from around the Chicago area all the way to Washington, D.C., very wide, up over the Appalachians, to the drought, and then to Hurricane Sandy in the fall. And none of those were necessarily caused by climate change, but they were all influenced by climate change. And as I said, if you had your eyes opened, that was the year that you said, hey, something's not right.
Now, a lot of people confuse climate and weather,
right,
and that's an easy
right,
an easy thing to do. So for people who are having a hard time sorting that out, you're talking about the weather that year, but it was an indicator that something is changing as far as our climate goes.
Exactly, yeah. And you have to be very careful. And I think this is one of the things that keeps people from understanding climate change, because they'll look at an individual weather event, one instance in a particular place, and they won't be able to put that into the larger climate picture, which is the broad trends over larger time periods and around the globe. So we have, with climate change, we have very small increases in global average temperatures, which in individual areas are leading to intensification of weather events and of the extremity of those weather events.
So when you look at the year 2012, what's the evidence that was climate change in action?
I think that the extremity of the weather, the fact that, for example, Hurricane Sandy would have occurred, but it what climate scientists are saying is that it wouldn't have been as large as it was, and it wouldn't have taken the route that it took. And to explain that in more detail would take too long, but basically that hurricane swept from the east to the west instead of going up to New York and then going out over the ocean. And that is thought to have been because of the position of the jet stream, which is, it's climate change. So, yeah, I discuss those things in the book a little bit more.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Cornelia Mutel. She is a senior science writer at Hydro Science and Engineering at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. Her most recent book is called A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. It's a part climate science education, part nature observation, part memoir. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow night at 7 o'clock reading. And coming up a little bit later on the program, I'll be talking with members of the band The Pines about their unique collaboration with photographer Danny Wilcox Frazier. That's coming up in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Cornelia Mutel. Her newest book is called A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And as I mentioned before, the book is a climate science education, but it's also nature observation, and it's also a memoir. And Connie, I would love for you to read just a little bit from one of the nature observation portions of the book.
Sure, I'd love to. As I said, I tried to take the events of my life and position them within the small area of our woodland and the surrounding woodlands and lands. And so here, this is the entry for December 27th, and I'm talking about a hike that I took with my husband after our grandkids left, grandkids and kids left that Christmas vacation. Several days after the snowstorm, Robert and I took a long walk starting at dusk. We hiked a 5-mile circuit on nearby gravel roads. The air was cold. We had to skirt patches of ice and hard-packed snow to avoid falling. High in the atmosphere, ice crystals scattered the rising moon's rays, giving the near-full globe a pinkish halo that grew larger, then smaller as we walked. Our route took us mostly through expanses of sleepy pastures with occasional small woodlots, nothing approaching our solid expanse of mature oaks, but still picturesque. With the countryside's uninterrupted coating of snow, the fields continued to glow brightly, even as dusk gave way to black skies. Outlines of gentle hills became more sharply accentuated. Slopes appeared as hummocks, smooth and white and round, as if they were the scattered breasts rising from this earth, or perhaps gigantic bellies early in pregnancy. It was as if this planet, our earth, was trying to declare its desire to create new life yet one more time, finding still another method of announcing its willingness to nourish and propagate all of its millions of life forms. And I chose that because I do have a passion for this globe, and I think that we need to address climate change with our minds and with our actions and with our science and with our economics and our politics and all of those ways. But I think it has to start with a love of the globe, with a love of the earth and all of the many millions of species that live there and are struggling to survive just as we are.
In the introduction to the book, you write about how in learning about climate science and climate change, you did go through a dark period that sometimes when you get really absorbed in the bad news, and there's a lot of bad news, it's hard to see the hope. And in this book, obviously, you focused on your love for the land and you share that. Do you think that's where the hope lies? Not even in necessarily fully understanding all of that bad news, but in really developing that love?
Well, that's certainly the case for me. I think that it may not be for everybody. But the thing about climate change is that it's going to affect everything. It's already starting to affect everything. So it doesn't matter what your passion is. My passion is for nature and for other species. I have friends that have a real passion for social justice, a passion for food production, a passion for education, a passion for health care and emerging diseases. It doesn't matter what your passion is. All of those passions are going to be affected by climate change. So I think you go where you are and you figure out what you can do, what you love, what you think about the things that you love, and then you insert a passion and an action agenda about climate change. And that's what we need to do right now. We really need to get on the ball and work on changing things rapidly.
I think about how we educate our kids about the environment. And since in many ways this is a love letter to your grandkids, I think you probably think about that too. And you're helping to cultivate a love of nature in them like you did with your sons. Sometimes when my kids come home from school and say, hey, we talked about the environment at school today and we talked about how polar bears are drowning. And I feel like, you know, I want them to know what's going on in the world. But sometimes I feel like the way we introduce the environment to kids today is so dark and so gloomy that it might make them feel hopeless before they can find that joy in nature. Do you worry about that?
Yeah, and I think that's a problem. I remember my mother, this is decades ago, many decades ago, saying that she thought children should be raised until the age of 8 or 9 or maybe 10 without having things imposed on them from the outside world and kind of just be free to be kids mucking around while they're still young. And I do think that you need to be very careful. I totally agree with that. What can I say? When we do things with our grandkids, I don't talk to them about the problems. I talk to them about the beauty of the earth. And I talk to them about my vision for the earth. I think we need to imbibe our kids with a vision for the future of a healthy, functioning, interacting earth with lots of species. And, okay, now it's our job to make sure that those species are healthy and they get what they need. And then you go out and you put up a bird feeder with your grandkids or something immediate like that so that they get the sense of action rather than overwhelming despair. Everybody is going to go into despair if you look at climate change with a little knowledge and don't go to possible solutions. You need to work on solutions as well as the problem.
The book is also part memoir, so you write about being a mother. You write about being a grandmother. You also share a number of other life experiences. You lost your own mother to cancer when you were only 18 years old. And I'm sorry.
Sure, go.
You also struggled with cancer yourself later.
Right.
And successfully at this point.
Yes, I am here.
Yes.
In the flesh.
I'm sure writing those things was difficult, and I'm sure also leaving a legacy for your grandkids, so they'll know you. They'll know
exactly.
You and what you've gone through. But I saw a parallel between the land that you love and you're writing about and the people that you love and yourself and cancer. Did you see this parallel between cancer and climate change?
Well, amazingly, it took a very good editor to point that out to me. I didn't see it at first. I found myself writing these memoir sections as ways of pulling the audience into the book without seeing that metaphor. And then someone worked and said, hey, you know, this is very obvious. Cancer and climate change are invisible, insidious increases in of small things that can kill. And the parallels are overwhelming once you see that. And yes, those sections were hard to write, but, you know, that's what you do. If you're going to be a writer and trying to be a good writer, you go to painful places. If you don't go there, the writing isn't any good. So I went there more as a memory as kind of a way of honoring my mother and her struggles and my entire family. And it was painful, but it was also very kind of purging and cleansing. I wanted to say something, too. Charity, you had talked about me being hopeless. And I am not hopeless in part because of my passion for the earth. And these things that I see in the earth that struggle to, you know, the nature is always ready to come back if we give it half a chance. But also, there are so many people and so many programs working on combating climate change right now. And I've gotten to know a few of these. But the mechanisms are out there. The people are out there. If we were to get a Manhattan Project right now to deal with climate change, which is what I think we should be doing, the people are there. The programs are there. The ideas are there. People are thinking outside of the box. There are cities and communities imposing a carbon tax, even though the federal government doesn't want to approach this. There are countries, many countries in the world, that have pledged to go carbon neutral by 2050. People are doing it. We are a little bit behind.
I'm talking to Connie Mutel. Her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. And Connie, in the end of the book, not only do you continue to observe this woodland that you love so much as you're heading into another winter, the next winter was far more significant than the one that preceded it, but you do end with a lot of messages about resources, about action that people can take. What do you want people to take away from the book? And I think you have a part that you want to read to us.
Sure.
About that. Why don't
I'd
you
love
read
to.
That and we'll talk more about it.
Okay. May I tell a short story first? I actually worked with two very fine editors on this book. And I love what one of them said to me. I was struggling with this final chapter. I had been exhausted by writing all the rest of it. And I knew I had to do something at the end. I couldn't just leave it with, we've got all these problems. So I kept working. I worked on drafting several final chapters on what we could do next. And I would show them to one of my editors. And she'd say, you know, nobody's going to read that. That's too long. It's too heavy. It doesn't work. It's dead. And I knew that was the case. And then one day she said to me, Connie, pretend you're in a burning building with 100 other people, and you are in charge of telling them how to get out. And I thought about that, and within a couple days, I had the final chapter written. So it's kind of a condensation of what we need to do as a society and what we need to do as individuals. And I want to stress that each of us can be active. You know, climate change is an incremental problem. It's not like on or off. It's going to be a little bit worse, a little bit better. So that if you end up walking to the grocery store instead of driving, you are in some infinitesimal way making the climate better for many millions, perhaps billions of future people and many millions of other species. And that's empowering. That's not depressing. That's empowering. And that's maybe something to work with when you're with your kids. Tell them to forget the polar bears for now. But another thing that I thought of was how we need to rephrase climate change. I mean, I think now people turn away from it because either they're ignorant, they're fearful. Maybe some oil magnates are turning away because they're greedy.
And it's been politicized.
And it's, oh, no doubt about it. It's a political belief system, which it isn't a belief system. It's a scientific theory about the way the world is functioning. So here is a reading on how we can rephrase or redesign climate change. It's a short paragraph from the last final chapter. How can we come to see climate change as a challenge that creates new possibilities rather than as a crisis that elicits fear? How can we accept climate change mitigation and adaptation as a method for stimulating creativity and our economy, even as it builds environmental health and a robust future? As a mechanism for uniting humanity around a common goal, a venue for expressing our commitment to future generations, an opportunity, not an indictment. The energizing challenge of a lifetime, our historic moment, our finest hour. I have talked to people who have said they were glad to be born now because this is such a huge challenge and they are ready for it. And I think that we as a society need to make that transformation to that way of thinking.
Sometimes I think about the incredible amount of progress that was made through the Industrial Revolution and all of the inventions that came about and the incredible ingenuity of the human species. And I feel like in some ways, because of our use of fossil fuels, that ingenuity kind of stalled out and was focused only on one sector. But at this point, it almost seems like the focus is shifting and there could be an explosion of new technologies.
So true. We're on our way. We are definitely on the way from a fossil fuel economy to a renewable energy economy. We're going to get there. We can accept that. We can all accept that because it's happening now. And the question is only how fast are we going to go? If we go too slowly, we're going to drag with us all of the exaggerated impacts of climate change. But if we work a little bit faster, we can create a much better future for all of us. So if we're going there, why not just put on the speed now?
In sharing your own personal story in this book, it also struck me how much things can change within a lifetime. In pointing out when you were a child, I think you said, and now I'm going to say the number wrong, but the population of the world was so much smaller. I mean, we've had this huge population explosion in your lifetime, which is part of what has created this pressure. So in another lifetime, what do you think we could see?
I think we're going to be seeing a very different world. We're definitely, things are changing right now. We shouldn't fight the change. We should instead try to shape it, which we're not doing now. If we deny change, then we're letting change take control. But in my lifetime, we went from about 2.3 billion people on the earth to, I think we're at 7.4 billion people on the earth. And that's right, three times as many people. Take away two-thirds of the people, you'd have a lot smaller problem. So exactly, that's exactly right. And I did trace that whole change in the environment since World War II. World War II was really a major change point where problems just erupted very rapidly because of synthetic chemicals and all sorts of things that we imposed on natural ecosystems.
Did writing this book give you hope?
Oh, that's a tricky question. In the short run, no, because it was a really hard book for me to write emotionally. Someone said as I was writing it, that one of an author's jobs is to process information so the readers won't have to do it. And I think I did that, and it was hard, and it was painful at the time, but I got through it. I'm really glad I got through it. I'm proud of this book. I look at this book now, and I love it. I love the descriptions of nature. I love the sense of being held in this woodland, which is part of this beautiful globe we live in, and just being held by nature's sanctity and integrity and wholeness. So, yes,
how
I think so.
Have your sons reacted?
Well, that's a good question. They should be here right now. They're, of course, proud of their mom, but I'm not an author. I'm a mom, and that comes first, yeah. So they say, good job, Mom, and let me tell you about what I wrote recently, which is just fine with me. Just fine with me.
Well, Connie, it's a beautiful book, and the cover is a stunning, beautiful, beautiful picture by Iowa City artist Claudia McGeehee, mm-hmm. which really captures the heart and the spirit of the book. So, Connie, thank you so much for being here
thank
today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Cornelia Mutel, her latest book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with David Huckfeldt and Benson Ramsey of the Pines and photographer Danny Wilcox-Frazier about a unique collaboration. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.